May 29, 1953. Sir Edmund Hillary, a Nepalese Sherpa mountaineer, Tenzing Norgay, became the very first climbers to reach the summit of Mount Everest. Very famous day. Years later, Hillary recalled the mountain's indescribable beauty. He said the great peaks were, quote, like glowing like balls of fire against the background of a dark velvet sky. They were entranced with the beauty of Mount Everest. Today, Mount Everest is horribly polluted. An article in National Geographic reports in the spring of 2012, more than 500 mobbed the summit, having paid $30,000 up to $120,000 to be on the mountain. The two standard routes are not only dangerously crowded, but disgustingly polluted, with garbage leaking out of the glaciers and pyramids of humid excrement befouling the high camps on the Mount of Everest. The trash keeps piling up as expedition teams leave behind a string of garbage from base camp all the way up to the summit of Mount Everest. There have been some attempts to clean up the trash, but because Everest is so cold and so icy, the waste that's left there stays there. I think of that mental image. I don't suppose any of us will ever reach the top of Mount Everest in this room anyway, but a mental image. I think of that mental image when I come to Genesis 6. This beautiful creation of God, perfect, we studied in Genesis 1 and 2, has been totally destroyed by sin by the time we get to Genesis 6, totally polluted by sin. Evil infests God's creation. Genesis chapter 6, verses 1 through 4. Now it came about, when men began to multiply on the face of the land and daughters were born to them, that the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful, and they took wives for themselves, whomever they chose. Then the Lord said, "My spirit shall not strive with man forever, because he also is flesh. Nevertheless, his days shall be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days, and also afterward, when the sons of God came into the daughters of men, and they bore children to them. These were the mighty men who were of old, men of renown." And the next phrase says, "Then the Lord saw that the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually." Evil infests God's creation. Now, these verses are transition verses. They sort of wrap up the pre-flood history of mankind, and they introduce the judgment of God that is coming in chapter 7 by way of the flood. The world had become so polluted by evil that God has to wipe out the world and start over with Noah and his family. That's where we're headed. At first glance, the verses seem clear enough, but this passage has been strongly debated over many, many years. And a whole bunch of questions are raised, and I don't have time to answer all of those questions this morning, but I'll do my best to cover the basic ones. And you take it from there in your own study. By the way, we have put out an updated question and answer list from our study of Genesis on the table in the foyer. It's also on the website. And we will continue to update that list as you have questions. If you have questions, most of you do anyway, you come and talk to me afterwards or write me an email. We'll do our best to include it. I'll do my best to include it in that list of questions and answers. Genesis, the early chapters of Genesis are so filled with so much, it's very hard to deal with it all, and I certainly can't in sermons on Sunday morning, so we'll do it that way. All right, but here's the first question for this morning. Who were the sons of God? All right? Who were the sons of God in this passage? There are three major views of this. First, they are the fallen angels or the demons. Second, they are the followers of God from the line of Seth. And third, they are the kings from the line of Cain. Dynastic word. The last view, let's talk about that one very quickly, is the least likely, in my opinion. It is true that pagan literature often referred to royalty and kings in the pagan world as sons of the gods. And there are those who argue that the Bible has borrowed from pagan literature here. But there is no evidence in the Bible for this title. No biblical writer ever treated pagan kings as sons of God. All right? Second view, the line of Seth, a strong case can be made that the sons of God here who go into the daughters of men were believers from the line of Seth, and that they were marrying unbelievers, the daughters of women, the daughters of men from the line of Cain. The sin then would be intermarriage between believers and non-believers in this passage. That is, the believers, the sons of God, follow the line of Seth, intermarried with the daughters of men from the line of Cain, and believers and unbelievers intermarried, and that's the sin here that God is judging. Those who argue from this for this viewpoint point to the context, and we have seen in our study of Genesis 4 and 5 that there's a strong distinction made between the line of Cain and the line of Seth. Genesis 4 is the line of Cain, this secular, ungodly world, and Genesis 5 is the line of Seth, the line that followed God and through whom God's Redeemer would come. The seed of the woman would come through Seth. Many passages in the Old Testament also prohibit the intermarriage of believers with unbelievers, and God takes that very seriously with the nation of Israel. And, of course, the concept of believers as children of God is a common theme both in the Old Testament and the New Testament. All right, while I think you can make a strong case that the sons of God here are the believers from the line of Seth and the daughters of men are the unbelievers from the line of Cain, I think a stronger case can be made for number one. All right, that the sons of God here are demons, that they are fallen angels. I think they are fallen angels or demons for the following reasons. Number one, the only other times when the phrase sons of God is used in the Old Testament, it is a technical expression for angels every time. Of course, it's not used a whole bunch in the Old Testament, but it's a technical expression for angels in the book of Job, which is the only other place where this term appears. Number two, two New Testament passages appear to identify angels with Genesis 6, 2 Peter 2, 4, and 5, Jude 6, and 7. We'll talk about that a little bit more in a minute. And number three, there is strong Jewish support for this view from the intertestamental period, the rabbinic literature, particularly from the book of Enoch, which was dated in the last two centuries before the birth of Christ. Now, the book of Enoch is not part of canonical scripture. It belongs to that intertestamental period. It's technically defined as part of the pseudepigrapha, if you care about that, which is the non-biblical writings that reflect, however, much of what Judaism was teaching and thinking, and a pretty reliable source for that kind of information. So for those reasons, I think these are fallen angels. These are demons. What was then the sin that polluted the world? Jude, in the New Testament, gives us clues to understand what happened here. Jude writes in Jude 6 and 7, "And angels, who did not keep their own domain, but abandoned their proper abode, he has kept in eternal bonds under darkness for the judgment of the great day, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the cities around them, since they in the same way indulged in gross immorality and went after strange flesh, are exhibited as an example in undergoing the punishment of eternal fire." Now, Jude, we know, was very familiar with the book of Enoch. In fact, elsewhere in the book of Jude, that little short book, he quotes from the book of Enoch in his letter, in the book of Jude, in the New Testament. So he certainly knew the Jewish rabbinic tradition regarding this passage. And here's the book of Enoch right here. In the book of Enoch, it says, "And it came to pass when the children of men had multiplied that in those days were born unto them beautiful and comely daughters, and the angels, the children of heaven, saw and lusted after them and said to one another, Come, let us choose us wives from among the children of men and beget us children." So I think the sin was fallen angels, if you will, demons, we usually refer to them, uniting sexually with human women to produce children, to produce offspring. The one argument against this, some of you might already be thinking about this, is the statement in the New Testament made by Jesus that angels do not marry in heaven. They neither marry or are given in marriage in heaven, Jesus said, Matthew 22:30. But just because angels in heaven don't marry doesn't mean that fallen angels or demons could not marry or could not have sexual relationships. So I would say these angels took on human bodily form. They married human women. We know that angels can take on human form because we see that elsewhere in the Old Testament. Many times, so we know they can do that, take on human form. By the way, just as a little aside, angels are always male in the Bible, always male in the Bible. They are never female. So many of our modern TV shows get the angel thing totally wrong, okay? That's just an aside. That's a freebie, right? All right, Genesis 6 says the result of this sexual union is that Nephilim were born to the women. The word is often translated giants. The giants were born to the women. And the reason it is translated giants is not from the Hebrew text, but from the Greek Septuagint, which translates this as giants. So, possible that they're referring to extra large human men, obviously. The only other place in the Bible where this term is used, Nephilim, is Numbers chapter 13 and verse 33. And that refers to the giants, the Nephilim, that Israel faced when they invaded the land of Palestine. Remember, the spies come back and said, well, there's Nephilim there, there's giants there in the land. Great warriors, great powerful men. The root word, the root of the Hebrew word means fallen. So these are fallen ones, or ones who fall upon others in battle. And that fits with the ongoing description you see in verse 4, where they were mighty men, men of renown, heroes, powerful warriors who fight and win battles. And that's the same in Numbers 13 as well. So it fits the description in both passages that the offspring were powerful warriors, mighty men of renown of old. Now, I'll just give you a total personal opinion here, okay? All right? So you can take this or leave it. You can go with it whatever way you want. Just don't blame me. All right. I think that Genesis 6 is the basis for all of those mythological tales of half-man, half-god people who were great warriors at some point in human history, figures who were powerful warriors here on earth. We see it, of course, in Homer's Iliad and the Odyssey, all sorts of other mythological kinds of stories. Many, many ancient mythologies contain stories of the gods and human women cohabiting and producing powerful offspring. I don't believe that Genesis 6 borrowed from mythology. See, that's what's wrong with that kind of a concept. Rather, mythology reflects the historical reality of what happened in Genesis 6 when fallen angels cohabited with women and produced these powerful offspring. All right, that's just an aside. There's too many asides in Genesis. God says here in this verse that he will not strive with humans forever. Confronting this evil, terrible world of humanity, God says he will not strive with humans forever. My spirit, verse 3, shall not strive with man forever, because he is also flesh. The word can be translated abide. My spirit will not abide in humans forever. Some of you like the ESV, and I think that's how they translate it here, if I remember correctly. I don't have it in front of me. But it's probably best, and it can mean that, but it's probably the Hebrew word, but it's probably best in this context to see it as striving. God will not fight humans forever. We have had the fall of man. We have had this humanity turning to evil. God striving, holding back evil, constantly fighting with humans. He says, I'm not going to fight with humans forever. He's going to put an end to what is happening. You remember in the Garden of Eden that God cursed Satan in the form of the snake, but he said that the seed of the woman would one day crush the head of the snake. And we know that we're talking ultimately about Satan. So through the seed of the woman was coming one who would ultimately destroy Satan. Satan then set out, here's his strategy, right? Satan set out to pollute humanity so that the Redeemer could not come. That's his whole strategy. It was all the way through the Old Testament. We celebrate Christmas. It was leading up to Christmas and following Christmas, right? Satan's strategy has always been to stop the Redeemer, the seed of the woman, from coming through the nation of Israel. And first Satan did it in Genesis 4 by corrupting Cain and his descendants. Cain killed Abel, created this immoral, ungodly society. Then I think he sends demons to impregnate women so that the human race would be perverted. And I believe this is why God had to wipe out the human race and start over with Noah and his family. At least one of the major reasons. All right, so God then intervenes to wipe out evil. Genesis 6, verse 5, then the Lord saw the wickedness of man was great on the earth, and that every intent of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. And the Lord was sorry that he had made man on the earth, and he was grieved in his heart. The Lord said, I will blot out man whom I have created from the face of the land, from man to animals to creeping things to birds of the sky, for I am sorry that I have made them. But Noah found favor in the eyes of the Lord. God intervenes to wipe out evil. So God looked at this perfect world that he had created, and he saw only evil everywhere he looked. Everything God looked at was evil everywhere he looked. The world had been totally polluted by sin. I believe also that God saw and understood what Satan was doing in polluting humanity with demonic seed. So God immediately stepped in. Jude 6 and 7 tells us that God stopped that process, and he confined those angels until the judgment day in eternity. He barred Satan from continuing this kind of attack on humanity. Never again would fallen angels be allowed to impregnate women. But the damage was done. Humanity was evil. The world was so evil that God repented that he'd ever made man. That's how bad it was. Now, the word repented is what we call an anthropomorphism, meaning that it is talking about God in human terms. Was God surprised at what happened? Not at all. Not at all. Did God change his mind in the sense of, whoa, I'm totally shocked at what happens and I don't understand it and I can't, No, God was not surprised in that way. The concept of changing his mind is an anthropomorphism, which means it is talking about God from the perspective of humanity. And from the side of humanity, God has decided to do something different. He is sorry in that sense because humanity has become so evil, and he is going to step in and judge them. So God changed his mind from the perspective of humanity and decided to judge his creation. He says, I'm going to blot out man and animals, birds and creeping things from the face of this earth. But what I want you to notice is that even in that decision to judge the world, God was gracious. God was gracious. Back in verse 3, we are told that man's day shall be 120 years. Now, that could be an age limit that God puts on humans. Remember, they lived very long back in those days. Could be an age limit that God puts on humans, except that we have numbers of humans that live beyond 120 years after this time. So it's probably better understood as a time frame until when? The flood. 120 years before I judge this world with the flood. And so that is an act of grace. That is, God is giving humanity 120 years from his decision to turn away from their evil ways and to turn back to him. And this is ever God's way, is it not? God always gives humans a chance to turn away from evil. God's warnings are his acts of grace to humanity. Peter, in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 20, talks about this, the flood, and this whole concept, and says that God's patience was exhibited toward humans before the flood as he gave humans a chance to turn away from evil. So I say that the 120 years was an act of grace, first of all. But now in verse 8, we have the first time that the word for grace is used in the Bible. This is the first place that grace, the word grace, appears in the Bible. And it is in verse 8, Noah found grace or favor. Same Hebrew word. Noah found grace or favor from God. So, what you have right here is one very thin line of the seed of the woman was preserved through Enoch, who walked with God, through Methuselah, through Lamech, and in Noah. God would not wipe out humanity entirely. Not going to do that. He would start fresh as an act of grace with Noah and his family. God's grace, thirdly, leads to man's righteousness. Verse 9. These are the records of the generations of Noah. Noah was a righteous man, blameless in his time. Noah walked with God, same thing that was said about Enoch. Noah became the father of three sons, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. Now the earth was corrupt in the sight of God, and the earth was filled with violence. God looked on the earth, and behold, it was corrupt, for all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. It's very important to see that grace, verse 8, precedes righteousness, verse 9. Grace, verse 8, precedes, comes before righteousness in verse 9. Noah found grace with God. He did not earn grace from God. See the difference? Many read these verses as if God sort of looked over mankind, you know, looked all over the earth, and he finally found one righteous man. And he said, okay, Noah's my one righteous man, I'm going to save him. That's not the way it worked at all. People say that Noah was a righteous man, so God saved him. No, that's not what we're talking about here. Noah is righteous as a result of God's grace. That's always God's way. Grace comes before righteousness. There is none righteous, no, not one, Paul says in Romans, right? And so he extends grace. We can only be righteous as a result of God's grace. God's grace, verse 8, produces righteousness, verse 9 in Noah. Right living is the demonstration that we have received God's grace. And we receive that by faith, as Noah did. All right, could there be a blacker picture of humanity than these verses? You know, we look around at our world and we think how sinful and evil things are, and our culture and our world, and how much violence there is, and that's all very, very true. But I'll tell you something, there has never been a point in human history that is or was as bad as Genesis 6. Evil had so invaded, infested the world system here. Earth had reached a tipping point with evil, if you will. God looked over earth and it was corrupt. It was filled with violence. Verse 12 makes it very clear that it's universal, right? The text says all flesh had corrupted their way upon the earth. All flesh. Now, Satan's strategy was nearing completion. The tipping point had been passed. He was very close to accomplishing his goal of totally ruining the seed of the woman so that no redemptor could ever come. Close, very close. As close as perhaps he ever will be in human history. He sought to fill this world with so much evil that mankind would be doomed, and he almost succeeded. That's how black this picture is. Yet into the blackness of sin was this single sliver of light called God's grace in the person of Noah, one person. God chose to show his grace to Noah. Noah, as a result, lived right in a world of evil. The line of Seth was not wiped out. The seed was not completely polluted. One man proved God's grace by living right in a rotten world. One man, one family, one hope. That's what it came down to for God to save this world. As a result of God's grace, one man stood up to evil. It's the power of one. You've heard it said, one plus God is a majority, always. Fourth principle, obedience stands against evil by faith. Verse 13, Then God said to Noah, "The end of all flesh has come before me, for the earth is filled with violence because of them, and behold, I am about to destroy them with the earth. Make for yourself an ark of gopher wood. You shall make the ark with rooms and shall cover it inside and out with pitch. This is how you shall make it: the length of the ark, 300 cubits, its breadth, 50 cubits, its height, 30 cubits. You shall make a window for the ark and finish it to a cubit from the top and set the door of the ark in the side of it. You shall make it with lower, second, and third decks. Behold, I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on the earth shall perish." So the end of all flesh is before me. All flesh has corrupted their way. I am bringing the flood of water upon the earth to destroy all flesh in which is the breath of life from under heaven. Everything that is on earth shall perish. That's pretty all-inclusive language, isn't it? Now, I understand the word "all" is defined by context, but the context here clearly indicates that all means all right here. Everything, everyone. God will wipe out everything that has the breath of life under heaven on earth by the flood. So it's going to be a universal flood. And God will start over with one man. That's it. God will use this great flood to cleanse this creation, but he will save one man and his family through a big boat. Now, I know the skeptics argue against a universal flood. And you have probably heard many of those arguments. And I will say much more about that next week, because we'll be dealing with chapter 7 and the flood itself. For now, let's just deal with the ark, or we'll be here too long this morning, all right? The ark was really more of a huge barge than a ship. Using a small cubit, and the cubit could be measured in different ways, but using the small cubit, 17.5 inches, the barge was 437.5 feet long and 79.92 feet wide. It was almost 44 feet high. There were three decks, 95,700 square feet, or 1,396,000 cubic feet in the ark. The gross tonnage, 13,960. This was a huge boat, but a very stable barge. In fact, studies have proven that the barge actually would have been even more stable with cargo, because the weight would have produced ballast, which would have made the possibility of capsizing very minimal. It was designed very well, which shouldn't surprise us since God designed it, right? For comparison's sake, the Queen Mary was 1,018 feet long, so a little over twice this length. It was not until 1858 that a boat called the Great Eastern was built that was bigger than the Ark. 1858. So the first thing we can say about this barge, as we look at it, is that the very size of the Ark proves this was not a local flood. There would be no reason for Noah to build something this big if he was just trying to escape a local flood. No reason whatsoever. And it couldn't be just to make a statement to the people, as some people suggest, you know, sort of an object lesson, since it wouldn't have any impact if there was no universal flood. And for that matter, if it was just a local flood, Noah and his family could have just migrated someplace else and lived, right? Noah clearly built a boat that would withstand a universal flood. Now, skeptics have argued that the size of the boat, well, they argue a lot of things about this, and we'll talk more about it next week, but one of the points here is that they argue that the size of the boat would have made it impossible for Noah and his three sons to build. That is, simply the beams and the structure and everything were just so big that one man and or four men would not have been able to build this. But you will notice there is nothing in the text to say that Noah did not hire people to help him build the boat. In fact, I suggest to you that he almost certainly did. higher people. Why? Because through Noah, as a preacher of righteousness, what was his job to do until the warning period is over? Talk to as many people as he could. What better way to do that than to hire a whole bunch of people to work on your boat? And while they're asking you, what in the world are you doing, Noah? You're telling them about God, warning them to turn away from their evil ways because there is a coming judgment. Noah was 500 years old when three sons were born to him, Shem, Ham, and Japheth. He was 600 years old when he entered the ark and the flood came. Clearly, it took Noah many, many years to build this barge. And throughout all of those years, Noah was preaching, warning people about God and the coming judgment. He was obedient over very many years. And for that matter, by the way, Enoch had preached about God's judgment many years earlier. We talked about that last week. He was obedient over very many years. And can you imagine how much ridicule he must have faced? How much scorn from people? In fact, 2 Peter 3, 5, and 7 implies that in that conversation about the flood, that God was being patient and that scorn and ridicule were being heaped upon him. I mean, the only way for Noah to have completed a project like this would have been by faith, total faith. In a world of evil, he believed God. He stood against evil by faith in God. What would you do if God gave you a project like this? What would you do? I mean, people would make fun of you. You'd be ostracized as a nutcase, a fruitcake. You know, I mean, you're crazy. What are you doing? Pouring all of your money? You got to invest for retirement, man. What's going to happen to you and your family? I'm going to be alive. That's what's going to happen to me. But nobody's going to believe you, right? Yet God calls us, every one of us, to be faithful to Him, even if we stand all alone in an evil world. And it could come to that. It has for followers of God down through the years. Obedience stands against evil by faith in God. It's the only way to live right in a wrong world. Fifth principle this morning, our salvation depends on God's promise. Verse 18, God says, "But I will establish my covenant with you, and you shall enter the ark, you and your sons and your wife and your sons' wives with you. And of every living thing, of all flesh, you shall bring two of every kind into the ark to keep them alive with you. They shall be male and female. Of the birds after their kind, and of the animals after their kind, of every creeping thing of the ground after its kind, two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. As for you, take for yourself some of all the food which is edible, and gather it to yourself, and it shall be for food for you and for them." Thus Noah did according to all that God had commanded him, so he did. It's going to be over a year. We'll see as we look at the text moving forward. But at the start, God established a covenant with Noah. The word covenant means that God had an agreement. That's what a covenant is. It's an agreement, but it is an agreement based upon a promise. The basis of all covenants between God and man, and there are many down through the Old Testament history, the basis of all covenants between God and man is a promise. God promised to save Noah. Noah's agreement to show his faith was to carry out God's orders to construct the ark. So his salvation was based on a promise from God and faith in that promise. He trusted God's promise. There's no other reason to work so hard on this project if God could not be trusted to carry out his promise? And the same is true for us. God makes a promise, we got to trust him. In the new covenant, God makes a promise of life to save us, and we live our lives in obedience to him because we believe him, right? We trust him. That's faith in his promise. Faith is always the foundation for the Christian life. If we didn't believe God, we wouldn't obey him. It's as simple as that. Obedience depends on God's promise. So verse 22, of course, ends with a statement that Noah did what God told him to do. He obeyed God because he trusted him. He took him at his word. We live in an evil world today. Anybody want to dispute that? The 20th century has been filled with violence. Evil is our country. Much evil abounds. We must obey God's commands because we trust God's promises, no matter what we face by way of evil in this world. It comes down to a matter of trust, of faith in God. There's no other way to live right in a rotten world. Two of every kind of living thing were to be brought into the ark. Actually, that's just for the unclean animals, chapter 7, verse 2. For clean animals, seven were to be brought into the ark, chapter 7, verse 2. For every clean animal, there would be three couples and one extra. The one extra, we assume, was for sacrifice, to worship God and to express our faith to God and worship, their faith to God and worship. Now, skeptics have long ridiculed the notion that so many animals from every kind could be saved in one barge like this. I'll deal with most of those arguments next week, but one issue rises from this particular section of the account. Skeptics argue, how could Noah gather the animals from all over into the ark? He would have to spend years rounding up animals all over the world. I mean, how does Noah get a kangaroo from Australia, for example, into the ark? Well, first of all, as we'll talk about next Sunday, the earth was very, very different back then. We talk about climate change. Well, we'll talk about climate change next week. How's that? Aside from that, how did the animals get in the ark? Well, the text answers that. Did you notice it? In verse 20. Two of every kind will come to you to keep them alive. How did Noah get the animals? He didn't. They came. They came to him. They came to the ark. God brings the animals to Noah. How? I haven't the foggiest notion. But I know God's capable of that, right? God could move the animals to get where they needed to be. And that's exactly what the text says he did. Somehow God moves the animals to come to Noah to enter the ark. Now, the sovereign creator of the earth is capable of doing that, right? But you have to believe in miracles. You have to believe that God can do something that is a miracle, because this is a miracle. The skeptics are wrong because they do not factor in what? Faith in miracles, that God can do miracles. And if you're going to boil down everything to the rational, then the flood's never going to make it, right? If it's just human reason. Because it is a miraculous process. The whole story is a miraculous story. Now, we can explain many things, but ultimately, it is the power of God that makes it happen. We too face an evil world. We too must stand up for God by faith if we're to live right in a rotten world. And the only way to do that is to believe in the power of God to do miracles. Because he is still a miracle-working God. Has he changed? God can still do whatever God wants to do. And we trust Him. That's the only way to live in a rotten world. So, stand up for God, even if you stand alone. Noah did. How about you? I love Christmas music, don't you? In our house, we have music going most all of the time until Christmas because there's just so much great music. Went to a concert Friday night. Christmas music, great. Loved it. Well, the Trans-Siberian Orchestra has a musical selection called Christmas Eve Sarajevo 1224. The arrangement has a wonderful story behind it. The Siege of Sarajevo was the longest siege of a capital city in the history of modern warfare. It lasted from April 5, 1992 to February 29, 1996. The siege lasted three times longer than the siege of Stalingrad and a year longer than the siege of Leningrad. The Trans-Siberian Orchestra heard a story, and hence the musical selection that was created. It was a story about a cello player who had been born in Sarajevo. The cellist left the country. When he was young, he went on to play throughout Europe. He became a very well-respected musician. Many years later, he returned to his homeland, and he returned to the city of Sarajevo as an elderly man. And he was distraught over the destruction of the city by his people. And as he lived there in Sarajevo during the siege, he was overwhelmed by all of it. And so this elderly man went into the town's main square to where a fountain used to stand and was now just a pile of rubble in the middle of the city. And he got out his cello and he began to play music, standing on that mound of rubble in the middle of the city while the city's being bombed. He refused to take cover. He just played his cello. First, he started with Mozart and Beethoven and some of the classical pieces. But very quickly, he got, especially as the season approached, he got to playing Christmas carols. And every night, he would go out in the middle of the bombing, and he'd stand on the rubble, and he'd play Christmas carols. Paul O'Neill of the TSO states, "It was just such a powerful image, a white-haired man silhouetted against the cannon fire playing timeless melodies to both sides of the conflict amid the rubble and devastation of the city he loves." And that's why they wrote their song. Another story comes from a Christmas day in Sarajevo when the Serbian army was shelling the residential areas of the city on Christmas Day. Numbers of people had died already. One reporter was downtown in the middle of the city when the terrible sounds of the shelling died down for a moment. And he was struck. He said, "I suddenly was arrested because from several directions, from several churches around the square, I heard people singing Christmas carols in the middle of the bombing." That is exactly the kind of spirit that it takes to live in an evil world. Look at the words of Christmas carols. If they aren't a statement of faith, I don't know what is. Peace on earth, goodwill to men. There's nothing like that. Every time we sing a Christmas carol, every time we celebrate Christmas, what are we doing? We are making a statement of faith that God is in control. And I can trust Him. And you can trust Him. No matter what you face, He's in charge. And we sing Christmas carols by faith. And we live out our lives by His grace. Father, we each face various challenges in life this week and in our world certainly. Help us to live by faith in Your grace and Your power, no matter what we face. Take us, take our lives, and may we live right in this rotten world. In Jesus' name.